The role of independent voters and possibly an independent candidate in this year's presidential election. The road to the White House during this campaign season has been an unusual one. Pretty crowded in the beginning, and since then, the remaining candidates have tackled lots of steep hills, strange distractions, and some might say, changing traffic laws. Another factor in this strange race is the makeup of the spectators. The crowd on the sidelines seems rowdy and unpredictable. And this is just the qualifying race. The general election is still to come. At that point, the candidates face a new challenge: how to win over independent voters, the largest group in the country. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss this race with all of its hairpin turns, including a possible contested GOP convention. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The polling firm Gallup reports that last year, 42% of American adults identified themselves as independent voters. Today, we're going to learn something about these voters, the issues that matter to them, and the role they may play in this election cycle. We're also going to talk a little bit about the possible contested Republican convention and the race for the White House in general. Joining me from our Augusta studio, Sandy Maisel. He's the William R. Kennan Jr. Professor of Government and founding director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. He is the author or editor of 17 books. Joining us from the studios of the Wall Street Journal in Washington, D.C., Dante Chinney. He's the director of the American Communities Project, a collaboration of the Wall Street Journal, PBS NewsHour, and WNYC Radio. He also writes the regular Politics Counts online column for the Wall Street Journal and is the creator of Patchwork Nation, which won a 2009 Knight Batten Award for Journalistic Innovation. Thank you both for being here today.
Thanks
for having us, Jen.
We, of course, want to hear from you as well. Are you an independent voter? Are you watching this election cycle with particular interest? Our number, 1-800-399-3566. You can also send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dante Chinney, right now in the U.S., the single largest group, as we just mentioned, higher than the number of registered Republicans or registered Democrats, is those who identify as independents. I'm wondering what this means this year in particular. I know it's common campaign strategy for candidates to appeal to the base during primaries, then tack center during the general election. But the base of both parties seems fractured, and no one seems to be giving the center any attention at all. So what happens next? Where do independent voters go?
Well, I think the thing to keep in mind about independent voters is we talk about how large a block of the U.S. voting population they are. But remember, a lot of them say they're independent, but when you really get down to it, lean one way or the other. And I think when you're talking about the true, I don't know how to say true, but the real independent vote in the United States, it's probably closer to 20%. And independent, remember, it's a broad term, so it can mean anything. There are some independents who don't identify with the Democratic Party because they don't think it's liberal enough. There are some independents who say a pox on both parties. There are some independents who are maybe Tea Partiers who are disaffected Republicans. So it's a kind of a big, amorphous, complicated group of voters. It's hard to really kind of pin down or figure out where it would go and say as a group in November.
So it's not necessarily a center group.
Absolutely not. No, it can be independents can be on the left and they can be on the right and they can be ostensibly off the spectrum somewhere in a different region altogether.
Well, Sandy, you know, we've all know the expression as Maine goes, and Maine has had a dominant block of independent voters a lot longer than that's been the statistic for the nation in general. What in Maine's experience might be instructive for the nation at large?
Well, first of all, I agree with Dante about who the independents aren't, which is there is no independent party. There's no block necessarily that are independents. In Maine, we've had a long history of citizens voting for candidates who are running without major party label. Senator King currently is in the Senate as an independent. But almost always when those candidates have been successful, certainly going back as far as Governor Longley in the 70s, there's been a very real split and almost a dysfunction between the two parties that has led somebody to come forward and to win. And in Maine, as in most other states in the nation, you win with a plurality that has more votes than anybody else, not a majority. And I think that's what is interesting to look at in the country now is there that kind of split between the Democrats and Republicans that would lead independents to say, I want somebody else. The other point that Dante made that is a very important point is that a lot of people who are saying to Gallup that they are independents are doing so because they don't like the concept of political party, but they always vote either Democratic or Republican. And he is absolutely right that the number who are true independents, and I like that phrase, true independents, is a much lower number.
Are those, Dante, are those true independents, though, concentrated in swing states? This is what I'm reading, that Ohio, Colorado, Florida, these are places where there are many, many more independent voters than there were even 8 years ago.
Well, you know, now this is like more in the wheelhouse of what I do. So specifically, when you talk about the differences between, you know, so-called independent voters in those states, I think what you're really talking about in some cases is disaffected voters, right? So in Ohio, look, it's going to vary from really the U.S. Geography is very complicated. The electorate's very complicated. But on the whole, the independent voter, I would say, in Ohio probably has more of a working class white cast to him or her. I think in Colorado, the independent voter has a bit more of a libertarian cast to him or her. And in Florida, I mean, in Florida, Florida is such a huge, complex state. It's hard to say what the independent voter truly, truly looks like down there. But, you know, even when you're talking about the difference between working class whites and kind of people of a more libertarian bent, they might both be independents, but the way you reach those voters is radically different. There are different ways you would reach out and try to connect with them. And it makes, you're talking about running a campaign that's going to appeal to those voters. It's really complicated. It's a difficult geography, difficult landscape to kind of process and figure out how to reach.
Sandy, go ahead.
Jen, if you could go back to the premise, which is that nobody is, during this primary season, appealing to the independent voters. I think that's, in fact, not true. That in the open primary states in which independents can vote, various candidates have been appealing to him. On the Democratic side, I think Senator Sanders has been appealing, and he's been appealing to independent voters who are on the left. And on the Republican side, certainly Mr. Trump has been appealing to them, and he's been appealing to some of these disaffected blue-collar voters that Dante was talking about. So I think it is a very complex group to reach and to identify, and then once you've identified them, to try to reach them.
All right. Sandy, what about an independent candidate that would be strong? Is there a Ross Perot or John Anderson out there this year?
I don't think there is. I think there is a great deal of, let's start with the Republican Party. There's a great deal of dissatisfaction in the Republican Party with either Mr. Trump or, in many cases, and I think it will increase if he becomes more serious, Senator Cruz. And there are people who say, we're not going to vote for either of those people. There isn't somebody who's saying, and I am the white knight coming in there, and I'm going to run as an independent to vote for them. For the libertarian aspect of that, you have Gary Johnson, who is a libertarian candidate, former governor of New Mexico, who is on the ballot in all 50 states. And I wager to say, somebody give me a number, but fewer than 5% of the people in the United States have ever heard of Gary Johnson. And I think, you know, that's really what the difference is. Mayor Bloomberg may have been that person at one point, but Mayor Bloomberg, I think, was willing to put his hat in the ring if he thought there was going to be a very liberal Democrat like Sanders and a very conservative Republican. I think his reading of the Democratic primary right now is that Sanders is not going to get the nomination. He's not going to there would be no place for him in a race with Clinton on the ballot.
There are so many scenarios out there being floated, one that there'd be a contested Republican convention and somebody other than Donald Trump or Ted Cruz would end up as the nominee. Another potentiality that I heard floated for the first time just a couple weeks ago is the idea that a third party candidate, a conservative Republican third party candidate, could be floated with the goal that no one would win all of the electoral votes and then Congress would decide the presidential race. Dante, what do you see at this point as being, I'm not even going to use the word likely, possible in the near future?
I know this isn't a year. This isn't a year for likelies at all. I mean, possible. It's looking more and more. I don't want to say likely, but it's more and more likely that we are going to have a contested convention, just because the road to the number of delegates you need to kind of lock everything down on the Republican side, 1237, That's the number you need. It's getting more and more difficult to reach for Donald Trump. It's extremely difficult to reach for Ted Cruz, but if Trump doesn't get the 1237, that means we go to the convention in Cleveland without him having the requisite number of delegates. And then what happens then is you take the vote. He doesn't have 1237, and all of a sudden you've got to figure out how are these delegates going to vote now? They become unbound, and they can do whatever they want. Look, I think that this idea, though, that we're going to have this third-party candidacy, I don't really see – I don't see how that's going to happen. I don't – I mean, who knows? Hey, that's the kind of year it's been. But I don't see how it's going to happen. And I also think that the idea that that third-party candidacy would – mean that nobody got to the majority of electoral votes, I think, again, it seems to be a bit of a stretch to me.
So, Sandy Maisel, you're prescient, however you pronounce it, because a couple years ago you said that we should get away from the convention system that we have now because something like this might happen. Tell us about your read on what's going on and what we're going to see.
Well, a former student of mine and I wrote a very sort of whimsical article about getting rid of the convention because exactly what might happen is going to happen, which is a decision being made by 2,400, 2,500 delegates of whom we know nothing. And that's what is clearly happening right now is these delegates are being chosen and we don't know who they are. Yeah. Dante is right that there's a path to the magic 1237 for Mr. Trump. We'll know a lot more after next Tuesday. He'd have to do very well in New York for that path to stay open. But if he doesn't get it on the first ballot, so the Republican rules say basically that delegates are bound for the first ballot, although there are about 300 delegates at this convention who aren't bound to anybody. Right. But they're bound in the first ballot. If he doesn't get the 1237 at that point, then people are going to try to take away some of the Trump delegates, and that's what's been happening at this point. Senator Cruz has been trying to get people elected as delegates who really are for him, even if they have to vote for Trump on the first ballot. And my point before and my concern now is this decision is going to be made by individuals who are up to any kind of incentives that you can imagine that we don't know anything about. And to me, that's really very troubling. We don't have any sense of what the incentives are going to be bring these delegates to a majority for somebody. We used to talk about a brokered convention. In order for there to be a brokered convention, I have argued for some time, there have to be brokers. And there's nobody who can be a broker who has any kind of power over these individuals. So you're going to tell the Donald Trump, the avid Donald Trump supporter, who he's going to vote for? Who's going to do that? I just don't see how it happens. So there may be a free-for-all that goes on for some time. And you know, people who've been in political science as long as I have, and that's a long time, as you know, Jen, we are, you know, sort of wishing to watch this convention. It'll be so much fun to watch. But in fact, you know, the fate of our democracy is at play here, and I'm not sure we want it in the hands of these people who we have no idea who they are.
Well, Dante, who are the names now? Paul Ryan yesterday took himself as adamantly as he possibly could out of the running to be that potential alternative candidate for the Republican Party. What names are being floated right now?
What do you got?
I mean, you're the one in Washington.
It is one of those. It's like, who's possible? It's like, well, what names do you want to mention? You know, anybody and everybody. Look, even after Paul Ryan's statement yesterday, I had friends emailing me who are Republicans saying that, look, he still left the door open technically. And it's just like, come on, man. He did not. The problem with the White Knight scenario, simply, first of all, I love what Sandy said about the brokered convention, which is completely true. And people have said as this thing has gone on, as these primaries have gone on and this contest has become more and more muddled, people have said, like, well, the Republican Party just won't let this happen. It's like, I don't understand who you think this so-called Republican Party is. These are people that are voting. And this is what they're saying. This is the process, man. But the names that are being floated are, but for this White Knight scenario, there are massive problems with this, okay? The Republican Party is trumpeting how great the turnout is at these primaries and caucuses and how wonderful it is and how engaged voters are. And this is great that they're coming out to vote. You're really going to do that and then go to the convention in Cleveland and say, thank you so much for all your enthusiasm. We don't want anybody that you voted for.
Exactly.
It becomes almost impossible. I mean, you're going to rip the party apart if you do that.
I think Speaker Ryan saw that as well. That
yes,
he was pretty clear that if he were to get the nomination, it would not be worth what people are saying to it now, because all of those people who voted for Donald Trump or for Senator Cruz would say, hey, you know, this isn't what we wanted.
And not just for this year, I think, but for somebody like, if you take this nomination, you have it hanging over your head. I mean, for the rest of your political career, you're the person that did this. And I'm sorry, Sandy Cohen, but it's just like,
I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right about that. The other point that I don't think has been made very well in the public press, at least, is Senator Cruz is working very hard to deny Mr. Trump this nomination.
Yeah.
What people forget is that Senator Cruz may be the least popular person in Washington, and that if he denies Trump, I don't see any logical sense that say they're going to come together behind him. So that you do get into the scenario that we're talking about, Jennifer. I think, however, that if I were to put my get my crystal ball out and try to figure out what it's going to say, I think if Mr. Trump gets very close, it's going to be very hard to deny him. So 1237 is the number that he needs. If he's over 1100, I think it's pretty hard to turn that back at that point.
All right. Well, on that note, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking about the presidential election, specifically the role of independents and the possibility of a brokered convention. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, committed to improving Maine's air quality through the conversion of landfill gas to energy. Casella, giving resources new life. And Sweetser, offering mental health first aid classes in several Maine locations. Course description and class schedule at sweetser.org.
Did it happen in one day?
The Golden State Warriors are on the verge of making NBA history, and the city they call home, Oakland, is reveling in the team's success.
The support that we receive around here is amazing, and so, you know, you can tell that it's doing a lot for the city. It's bringing life to the city.
A team and a city rising together, later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Shoot a three-pointer in his face.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 o'clock.
Your coffee beans, your soda cans, your smartphone. Ever think about the distance they traveled before you purchased them? On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Edward Humes discusses his new book, Door to Door, about the transportation infrastructure behind our consumer-driven economy and possible transportation breakthroughs like the driverless car. Join us.
That's coming up on Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, this unusual election cycle, we're talking independent voters, contested convention, potential third-party candidates. With me, Sandy Mazel, a professor of government and founding director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. And Dante Chinney is the director of the American Communities Project, a collaboration of The Wall Street Journal, PBS NewsHour, and WNYC. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Our email is talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And we're going to start with Nathan, who's calling from West Bath. Hi, Nathan. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? I am, as he said, as your spokespeople said, I'm a left-leaning centrist. Central voter. I just feel like both parties have really just disenfranchised the entire United States, because they don't seem to be focusing on the issues that really are driving this election, and I think that's why everybody's gravitating towards the fringes, because these folks are really pushing the issues that are really deep-seated. I'm a union electrician, and, you know, all of my work has gone overseas, everything. All of my factories have shut down. I have nothing to do as far as skilled labor. You know, I mean, I can go out and wire commercial buildings, but there's only so many of those. You look around, there's so much commercial property available that we're not really building anything anymore of that caliber. And it's kind of funny that the Republicans are crying, considering that in 2000 that we had a contested election and the Supreme Court ruled in their favor, and it was a vote that actually went to the Democrats as far as a popular vote. So
Let me ask you this, Nathan, though. Yeah. It's interesting to me because you said that the issues that they're talking about are not the issues that matter to you. But I know at least Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are talking a lot about the trade agreement. So they are talking about them. Are there others?
What I see, though, is every time you turn around, the media in general seems to turn the spotlights back on their favorites, which is Hillary Clinton and, I don't know why, Ted Cruz. But, and you're not seeing, you're not getting the airtime that, because I do, I will be voting for Bernie Sanders. There's no question in my mind, because I don't trust Hillary Clinton. I don't trust the way she votes. I don't trust her past, and her husband gave away my job.
Okay, let me ask Dante Chinney about this, because this is really what you're looking at, Dante, when you're looking at American communities. Does Nathan speak for many Americans?
Well, I think he does, and that the loss of jobs and what's happened to the country, I would argue, I grew up outside Detroit. I would argue this stuff has been going on for a very long time, and, I've watched all this happen throughout the 80s. I watched the jobs go away. And I think what Nathan's saying, particularly about the gravitation toward independence and away from the two parties, is that the real thing that's going on in this election with Trump and with Bernie Sanders, and we're all focused on 2016, but there's more happening in 2020 and 2024. The parties are dissolving. Both of them are. I mean, the GOP really clearly is dissolving this time around. But the Democrats as well. We're going through what we politicians, and I know Sandy probably hears about this all the time, but we're going through a realignment. And I think we're still at the very early stages of it. The parties are going to look different if they're here, and I assume something will be here in the next decade, because the issues are changing really dramatically. It's interesting that, somebody like your caller who, watched their job go overseas. I mean, I wonder if he'd be interested in voting for Donald Trump, since Trump is talking so much about, things Republicans never used to talk about, which is tariffs and building up trade walls, not just walls in the Mexican border.
Nathan, how do you feel about Trump?
Well, Trump is interesting. I think Trump is kind of a sheep or a wolf in sheep's clothing. I think that if you look at Trump's history of some of the things he's said in the past, I think he's far more liberal than a lot of people want to let on to. But I do agree with a lot of the things he says. I mean, if you've got, like, even in this state, you've got Canada, who supplements their paper industry, and where has our paper industry gone? To Canada. Those folks, and it's an unequal playing field, and, I mean, you look at all the regulations that we have on our environment. I lost my mother to Cancer Valley in Rumford. I mean, she passed away when I was 5 years old from cancer, and she grew up in Rumford. And now we've shifted all of that environmental burden overseas with absolutely no protection to our industry. Our industry here, we have to provide clean air. We have to provide clean water. Over there, they don't. And so they get away with making all this money over there, shipping the stuff over here, saying that they're saving us money, but they're really not, because eventually somebody else over there is going to be living in Canada.
Right. Well, Nathan, I think you speak for a lot of people. I want to turn it a little bit, Sandy, and ask you about what Dante just said, that the parties are dissolving. This is a historic realignment. Can you give us some historic perspective? When is the last time we saw a shift like this? Is it the civil rights movement and the movement of the South to the Republican Party?
That was the last time we saw a particular segment of a party breakup, which was starting with the Goldwater election in 64. But the last major realignment, most political scientists say, happened in 1932, when the current setup of the Democrats and the Republicans happened. And it is very clear it has disaggregated. Both parties have disaggregated since 64. But where Dante is absolutely right is they haven't come together with new cores. There has always been a liberal and a moderate part of the Democratic Party. There has, in recent years, been a social conservative and an economic conservative part of the Republican Party. And what looks like it is happening right now, and I somewhat disagree with Nathan, the caller, because I think, in fact, the Democratic Party is moving to the left generally because of Bernie Sanders, whether he gets the nomination or not. It's clear that Secretary Clinton has taken positions like her resistance to the Trans-Pacific Partnership because of the Sanders campaign. And I think it's also clear, as Dante has said, that the Republican Party would like to be moving to the right. But Donald Trump does not represent the part of the right that the Republican Party wants to be moving to. Senator Cruz or Senator Rubio earlier on represented much, and frankly, Governor Kasich represents much more of that conservative part of the Republican Party. Something is going to, the parties are going to adapt, and they're going to adapt over a period of time. I would like largely argue because they always have, but it's mostly because the structure of our system requires political parties to aggregate voters in a way to get enough votes to elect somebody. Your friend Mark Brewer, Jen, and I have edited a book together for a number of years called The Parties Respond. And the theme of that book, which has been coming out since the 80s, and every 4 years it comes out again, is essentially that whatever happens to the system, the parties figure out a way to respond to changing issues, to the changing campaign finance laws, to different kinds of personalities. In each case, the parties have figured out a way that they have to adapt because our system requires two parties.
Okay. Nathan, thank you so much for your call. I want to ask you, Sandy, before we get to the other calls that are waiting, something about what you said about Hillary Clinton, that Bernie Sanders has pulled her to the left, especially on issues such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. If Hillary Clinton does indeed get the nomination, do you believe she will stay where Bernie Sanders has pulled her to?
Well, you said earlier on that there is a tremendous tendency in the general election for every candidate to moderate from where they have been, appealing to their own ideological base and their party, towards the center. And I think there's some inevitability of that in both candidates. But I believe that Secretary Clinton has taken positions that she was almost hesitant to take. She's a very conservative in the sense that she doesn't go way out there personally. Person, I think she's taken positions to the left that she was hesitant to take and seen that they have done quite well. So she has been talking about income inequality. She has been talking a great deal about, she's talked much more about trade than she ever had before. She's talked a great deal about LGBTQ issues that she never was out front on before. Number of women's issues, which she always has been out front on before. Defending Obamacare very vigorously, those kinds of issues. I don't think she's going to change on those. And in fact, she's going to use those to distinguish herself if it is a traditional conservative Republican candidate, somebody of the ilk of Senator Cruz. I think if it is somebody like Mr. Trump, who is the nominee, that she is going to be running more on experience and on being steady and on being predictable in a crisis, which I think voters fear he would not be.
Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Evelyn, who's calling from Auburn. Hi, Evelyn. Go ahead.
Hi. Every time I turn on the radio or television to a discussion of the election, I always hear about the Republicans first. And not only first, but they seem to spend more time on them than they do on the Democrats. I'm very much in favor of Hillary Clinton. And the Sunday paper in Maine had a long article on all that President Obama has accomplished. And I feel that Hillary Clinton agrees with him on many issues, and that she's had far more experience than anybody else that's being considered.
All right. And Dante, is Evelyn right? Are the Republicans getting more attention than the Democrats? And if so, is it just because it's more interesting over there?
Well, they do have this guy named Donald Trump, which does tend to lend itself to more coverage. Yeah, I think it is more interesting. And look, the Democratic race is not over yet, okay? But it's getting near the end. And I know that Bernie Sanders people will get upset about this, and I'll probably have people tweeting all sorts of evil things at me and talking about how horrible I am. But, you know, I thought that was a really interesting exercise that CNN went through last Tuesday, which was with Wisconsin. And they had his campaign manager on, and they went through they've got the wall where they tick off all the states. They gave him all remaining states 55-45. He wins every state left, including New York, by 10 points, which isn't going to happen. And even if that happens, he's just too far behind in delegates. It becomes very difficult. Then it becomes a question, can he swing superdelegates, which we can have a long discussion about why I think that's highly unlikely. But, you know, the Republican race is undecided. It's going to keep getting more attention because we simply don't, we've never seen a race like this before, and we don't know what's going to happen. We really don't. We don't know what's going to happen. I mean, after Wisconsin, I was walking out of here, after the primary in Wisconsin, I was walking out with the bureau chief, Jerry Seib, and we were talking about what was going to happen in the Cleveland convention, and he just smiled and said, you know, bring a gas mask. It could get really, really crazy. It could get really crazy. And, you know, that's not, I'm not cheering for that, but it's just reality. And so we don't know what's happening. It's a much more interesting race.
Sandy.
Two things. First of all, the great Washington Post columnist David Broder used to write a yearly column in which he talked about all of his mistakes. Can you imagine if every journalist had to write a column now talking about all the mistakes they've made just in this primary? I think Dante is right, and I want to thank the caller. I've never been on with you, Jennifer, in which anybody said I've talked about the Republicans more than the Democrats. I seem to usually get the other criticism of mine. But I think that's exactly right. Mr. Trump, if he is nothing else, is a master of getting media attention. Last Sunday was the first time in over a year and a half, I believe, that he hasn't been on one of the Sunday talk shows, and then everybody writes about what he says on the Sunday talk show. He has spent less money by far than Jeb Bush did, but also than Senator Cruz has, but has had much more publicity because he is good at doing that. The Democrats, I think, have gotten in many ways, because Senator Sanders has been such an interesting candidate, more attention than one would think they would have. But I also agree that with Evelyn that, in fact, Secretary Clinton is likely to get this nomination, and with Dante, likely to get this nomination sooner rather than later, or to sew up the nomination sooner rather than later. And what that's going to do is to increase the media attention on the Republican nomination, because that's the only story that's going to be out there.
And do you agree, Sandy, with Dante, that we really don't know what's going to happen? I mean, I suspect that you as a political scientist have a pretty good idea of who's going to be our next president at some point in the year of the election, usually.
Yeah, usually. I mean, 2000 we didn't, as an example, but until sometime after the election. But
of course.
I think what is fascinating to me as a political scientist, I have always tried to, when I've gone on public media, talk about what I know as a political scientist as opposed to what I think as an informed citizen. And I think as a political scientist, I can talk about the rules. I can talk about various scenarios that could happen, right, but I don't know what is going to happen. And I don't think anybody, political scientist or journalist or anyone else, really knows what is going to happen. None of us foresaw, I don't know anybody who foresaw Donald Trump being the kind of force that he has been, nor that he has been capable of running a campaign to which Republican after Republican after Republican has been incapable of responding, starting with Jeb Bush.
Well, on that note, we are going to take another short break. Interesting conversation with Dante Cheney and Sandy Maisel about this year's presidential campaign. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Central Maine Heart and Vascular Institute, offering quality care for your heart, from the heart, close to home. Learn more at cmhvi.org. And Hussin University, offering a new master's degree program in pharmacology starting fall 2016. Information at hussin.edu.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, we'll hear from Dr. Ayanna Howard, a leading authority on robotics. She'll discuss current applications of artificial intelligence and the future of robotics with Dr. Indre Viscontis. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock. MPBN Television brings you 3.5 hours of in-depth quality public affairs programming each evening. Charlie Rose starts off at 4:30 each afternoon, followed by The Journal from Deutsche Welle at 5:30 with an international and European focus on world events and issues. Next comes the BBC World News at 6, then the Nightly Business Report at 6:30, and finally, the PBS News Hour at 7. That's news the way it should be, public television style. Relevant global perspectives, thorough analysis, and essential understanding of important issues of the day. It's news you can trust. It's right here on your public television station, MPBN Television, starting at 4:30 each weeknight.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Independent Voters and This Year's Presidential Campaign. With me today, Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project and author of the regular Politics Counts online column for The Wall Street Journal. Sandy Maisel is a professor of government and founding director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Jonesboro and Nancy. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hi. How you doing?
Great.
I think that I'm a Bernie supporter because I am a very informed citizen. I'm on Facebook right now. And I'm looking at a picture of Bernie Sanders visiting FDR's grave, likening his fight against the billionaire class to FDR standing up to economic royalists. I think that neither Trump nor Sanders will be allowed, and the mainstream media has really been derelict. They just have refused to cover Sanders until recently when he won 8 out of 9 states, because they are both opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the people who actually run this country, the corporations and the billionaires, want it very badly.
Wait, so you think the press is not covering Sanders because you think the press is for the TPP?
Well, they are for Hillary because they know Hillary is Goldman Sachs and Wall Street and Monsanto and GMOs.
Okay, well, I can speak as a member of the press that I'm not deciding what programs I do based on that, but why don't I throw that to Dante? What's your response?
I hear this complaint from people often, and I guess my response would be, you know, Bernie didn't get more serious coverage until things got very serious, and he made more of a game of it, more of a race of it, and he got more attention. That's just, I think, generally how the system works. I would argue, though, if it really is just about, and we don't take orders here or I think at any media organization from the ownership about stories that we have to do. But I would say that if the argument really is the TPP and people wanting stability for the economy, then we wouldn't be giving Donald Trump the coverage we're giving him. I mean, Donald Trump is actually for things that are kind of anathema to large corporate America in terms of tariffs and things of this nature. I mean, there's something remarkable happening this year within the GOP. And I think we've done a very good job covering it, actually, of people being against trade. And the most remarkable finding in the exit polls consistently on the Republican side is a majority of Republican voters believe free trade hurts the country. We've reported that, and it's remarkable because it's a shift in what the party is all about. So, I mean, if it really was, if the media was just being driven by being pro-trade and pro-TPP, Trump wouldn't be getting the attention.
Well, sure, and Trump has said things about press freedom that most members of the press corps wouldn't be very happy with as well.
Yeah, well, that's Trump said a lot of things that are interesting.
And as a non-member of the press, Trump has abused individual members of the press in a way that in many other societies wouldn't be tolerated. I think the question on Sanders is a much more interesting one, though. I'm trying to call up the actual numbers. There was a report about amount of free press that the various candidates have received in the last 2 months. So to the caller's point, this doesn't go to the beginning of the campaign. But in the last 2 months, Sanders and Trump have had much more free press. Trump more than anybody else, Sanders second, and then a big gap before you get to Hillary and to Cruz. And I think, quite frankly, it's because the Sanders campaign has done a very good job of creating press opportunities, a much better job than the Clinton campaign has done.
All right. Well, Nancy, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Carol, who's calling from Belfast. Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you for addressing some of these issues. In the past few days, I have heard a new phrase being used by NBC, CBS, MSNBC, and I heard it earlier on this show, which is troubling me to my heart's core, and that is the use of the phrase, the Republican Party, who is their white knight? Now, I think that is supposed to be maybe a phrase that comes out of, looking for a knight in shining armor that has been skewed to white knight. I am so incredibly offended by the use of white knight.
Do you feel as though that's racist?
Yes, to its core. And I do strongly believe that in the past 8 years, part of the gridlock in Washington, D.C., goes back to the night of President Obama's first inauguration, when that large group of senators and congressmen and Republican Party leaders gathered. Instead of going to the inaugural festivities, they gathered at a hotel restaurant, and plotted to make President Obama a one-term president.
All right, Carol. Dante, do you have thoughts about her problems with the phrase white knight?
I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, I just used it myself. I mean, just to be so. I'm sorry. I don't mean it in any context like that. I don't think anybody else does either. You know, the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition, just to be clear, is someone or something that rescues or saves another person or thing from a bad situation. And I think that's the term. That's the way I was using the phrase. But that's good to know that people out there. I will avoid trying to use it in the future if people feel that way about it.
I fear I probably used it as well, and I've never heard somebody being offended by it, and I will try to avoid it as well. But it certainly is in the sense of a knight in shining armor coming in to save the damsel in distress, or the nation in distress in this case, or the party in distress in this case.
Carol, thanks for your call. We're going to move to Frederick, who's calling with a 207 number from Santa Rosa, California. Frederick, are you on vacation, or did you move?
No, I'm just here on winter.
lucky dog. Well, it's very pretty here today. You should come back.
Well, I won't tell you how beautiful it is here with all of this rain we've had. I'll come back when the swallows return. But I have to say something. I have to give the media a little bit of credit, and then I wanted to take a task with you, Jennifer, for about a comment you made, and then make that as a second point. That indeed, I think the media is right to describe this hunt for a third person in the Republican primary as their white knight, because as we know, the Republican Party and the conservative movement is basically race baiting in the society to, of course, block minority people from voting. They're very clear about this. It's been successful in Wisconsin, North Carolina, Ohio, et cetera. That is a point that, of course, public radio and the media in general really needs to call the kettle black, let's say, and make this a clear part of their game plan for the general election. So let's allow the media to call the truth out on this attempt by the Republicans to withhold the vote. But then the other point that I wanted to make about the media, Jennifer, you had referred to the attention that the Republicans have been getting and Donald Trump being far surpassing any of the attention that the Democrats get. And you said, is the Republican campaign just more entertaining?
And I think the word I used was interesting.
Interesting, right.
And it was a question, not a statement.
Well, to back up your point as a bit of the truth from another person in the media, the president of CBS admitted that, indeed, there's rating games with this buffoon, with this clown, Mr. Trump, and that they will continue to provide him coverage. Now, let's watch tomorrow. My final point is, let's watch tomorrow. Bernie Sanders is going to meet with arguably the most powerful person in the world outside of America, and that's Pope Francis. And let's watch to see what kind of coverage Senator Sanders is going to meet with as he talks economics and economic justice with the Pope. And I wonder how public broadcasting and the rest of the media will focus on, will give him that attention.
Well, Frederick, let's look at that because, you know, I have to say I've worked in both commercial broadcasting and in public media, and the attention from the inside on ratings is much, much, much dramatically less important in public radio. But Dante, I'll you know, send this to you because I know that you work with NBC News. You also work for a newspaper that wants to sell copies. How much is this whole, and especially with all these cable channels,
yeah.
How much are we trying to attract listeners, viewers, readers with the decisions we make every day in covering presidential candidates?
Well, I mean, it's a fine line, right? I mean, the job is to get people to read the stories that matter, but you also want to get eyeballs to the site. I do think that NBC, I work at NBC with Chuck Todd and the political people, and I do, to Chuck's credit, I think when he said that no more calling in for Donald Trump on the show, this has gotten ridiculous, he's got to come on the show like everybody else if he wants to talk. So I give him credit for doing that. But look, you know, there's no question, Donald Trump drives ratings. As much as he bragged early on about how people are tuning into the debates because I'm up here, that's why I'm getting you so many good ratings. Look, there's an element of truth to that. People are tuning in, or they were. I think it's probably less of a factor now because people know him. But look, there's no question he drives ratings. I don't think that affects the coverage at the Journal. I don't think it affects the coverage at NBC. But, you know, it is a reason why he is getting the coverage he's getting in some cases in terms of being on the air when he just calls in. I would say also, though, remember, like, what's happening in the Republican Party, he is shaken up that party in a way that that I knew something like this was coming. I wrote about this back in 2013. But if you had told me that Donald Trump was going to be the person who was going to be the messenger on this stuff, I would have burst out laughing. It's what's happening is remarkable right now.
All right. Thanks for your call, Frederick, and come back home soon. We're going to Karen. Karen calling from the road. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I was just hoping the panel could comment a little more on the Democratic superdelegates, because what is very confusing to me is it seems like Senator Sanders is really surging, and, you know, maybe he won't have a prayer of actually beating Hillary in the outright delegate count, but even if he comes closer with a little ahead, these superdelegates, everyone is just saying that, oh, well, they're going to vote for her anyway, and she's going to win the nomination. And it seems to me, you know, what does that say to all the people in the Democratic Party who are out voting if these 600 and whatever they are just going to give it to Hillary? I just don't really understand that.
Okay. This is your area of expertise, Sandy Maisel. Explain
sure.
this.
Let me take that on. First of all, I think it's important for everybody to understand that Senator Sanders still trails Secretary Clinton by about 200 delegates among elected, pledged delegates. He is surging. He has won 8 of the last 9, but he has won 8 of the last 9, frankly, mostly in very small caucus states, often not by very many votes, so that in Wyoming, for instance, they, in fact, got the same number of delegates after that. So the question for the superdelegates comes down to which of these candidates is better to win in the general election. And their general, you know, I think it is not by chance that today or maybe yesterday, for the first time, one of the senators, Democratic senators, Senator Merkley from Oregon, endorsed Senator Sanders. He is the first one. It is because the people who have worked with him for 20-some years in the Congress don't think he would be a very good president. That's why they haven't endorsed him. They may be wrong. They may not speak for where the citizens feel, but that's in fact the reason they haven't endorsed him. And they don't think he would be a good candidate in the general election, and they don't think that he would be as good a president as Secretary Clinton. If as happened in 2008 when she was also leading, I'm sorry, in 2008 when she was also leading in the early count of superdelegates, if Senator Sanders were to demonstrate that he has this groundswell of majority support among the Democratic voters, they would switch, just as they did to Barack Obama in 2008 when they had been with Hillary. But Senator Sanders has not demonstrated that. He has won, I can't remember the number, and the numbers don't matter, but something like 1.5 million fewer votes than Secretary Clinton has so far in primary states. He is 200 delegates behind. I think all of those factors are what are driving the superdelegates to stay loyal to Secretary Clinton, and they are pragmatic enough to know that none of those factors is very likely to change in the states that are ahead. They're looking at the calendar. They understand where candidates' strengths are. Senator Sanders has done a remarkable campaign and will continue to do so in some of those states, but I don't believe he is going to beat her. I don't believe he's going to catch up the number of votes that he has received compared to the number of votes that she has received, and certainly not the number of delegates.
Dante.
There's one other point. Those are great points, by the way. The other point I'd note is that, you know, look, the Democratic Party at this point is 40% of the Democratic Party is made up of minorities. And Senator Sanders, this is a real point in which he struggled. He has achieved 50% of the minority vote. In the states where we have exit polls, He's achieved 50% of the minority vote in one state, New Hampshire, and he got exactly 50% there. For him to win over superdelegates, he'd have to have this groundswell of support, and he'd have to show that, you know, this big weakness that he has of minority voters, that he could do something about it, because those people have to be excited come November.
All right. Well, Karen, thank you for your question, and I think that's going to have to be our last question for this hour. We're almost out of time. What a great conversation with Sandy Maisel, Professor of Government and Founding Director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College, and Dante Chinney, Director of the American Communities Project. It's a collaboration of The Wall Street Journal, PBS News Hour, and WNYC. He also writes an online column for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you guys both for being here today.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. We had additional help from Mal Leary in our Augusta studio. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at midnight. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and Maine resident Richard Russo joins me to talk about his new book, Everybody's Fool, and about the writing life. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.